Well, for the penultimate session of the day, PLP obviously wanted a nice, uncontroversial and straightforward topic, which is why they picked Brexit and public law, which Martin is going to address on the day in which the Prime Minister has refused to give Parliament a vote on Article 50. Martin Chamberlain, QC, will need little introduction to most of us, a leading practitioner in human rights, in public law, commercial law, and EU law. In the great tradition of the bar, not only a firm supporter of PLP and a firm advocate for claimants in many cases, but also almost standing counsel, Martin, to the Lord Chancellor in cases that PLP bring. I didn't know whether to mention that or not. I thought I would. But really, again, no one better to talk us through the issues that are going to arise in Brexit from the public law perspective.
Thanks very much, Richard. I want to start by taking you all back to the 24th of June. You probably all remember, it's one of those occasions, a bit like when Kennedy died, that people can suddenly remember when someone asks them to recall where they were when they heard the result of the referendum. Well, I was in the middle of a hearing, and quite a few of the lawyers in the room had been up all night. And I think it would be fair to say that quite a lot of us were in shock. And it wasn't only those who had voted Remain who felt that way. Quite a few who had voted Leave did too. And I came back to my chambers, which specialises in public and EU law, amongst other things, and some of my colleagues were in tears. Not, I think, because they feared for their own futures, but because they feared what this vote said about the country they belonged to. I can't honestly recall a political event that has evoked such a profound emotional reaction. Since then, we as public lawyers have, I think, been going through what psychologists call the seven stages of grief. First was shock and denial. The referendum was only advisory. The courts might intervene. There is still a Remain majority in Parliament. The PM has resigned and no one is in charge. And finally, maybe Nicola Sturgeon will save us. Second was pain and guilt. Pain for the Remainers, a part of my political soul has been ripped out, and guilt for the Leavers. It's all my fault for believing the promises on the side of those buses. Third, anger and bargaining. It's all the fault of our venomous press. We're a country that hasn't come to terms with its place in the world. Now, I did wonder which of these seven stages we could say we were in now. And I think the answer is about number four, which, according to the very helpful website recoverfromgrief.com, is characterised by depression, reflection and loneliness. Angela Merkel has stopped saying positive things about special deals for the UK. François Hollande thinks we are going to have to suffer for our sins, and even the Norwegians won't talk to us. Anyway, my subject today is Brexit and public law, and I want to tackle that subject with the aim of moving our particular community, the public law community, towards the next and more positive stages of grief, the upward turn, reconstruction and working through, and finally, acceptance and hope. Now, one very small silver lining that I suspect many of you will recognise from the referendum is that most instructions one receives these days comes with a question at the end along the following lines. Is the above affected by Brexit, and if so, how? And I'm always heartened by that question because it's one of the few occasions that you actually get to charge money for giving a completely accurate but also utterly vacuous answer. Absolutely no idea. My aim today is to get just a little way beyond this and at least pose some of the questions relevant to public law that will need to be answered in the next few months. And I say pose rather than answer advisedly. I saw this morning that the Labour Party, whose efforts on this front are being led by the great public lawyer Sir Keir Starmer, had published no fewer than 170 questions for the government to answer about Brexit, one for every day between now and the end of March, the latest date by which we are told the Article 50 notification will be given. Now, I'm not going to have time today for 170, but I want to consider five questions or groups of questions that are of particular relevance to public lawyers. Now, the first, I'm just going to really give you the questions which I think arise, because it's the obvious question: who gets to push the button on Brexit? And the answer to that is going to be determined by the case which starts tomorrow in the Divisional Court, and I think everyone is assuming will end in the Supreme Court later this term. That case offers up, as Professor Elliott said, a smorgasbord of fundamental constitutional issues. Can the prerogative authorise the doing of an act that in practice will undermine rights and obligations given effect by statute? Can a sharp distinction be drawn between acts operative on the international plane and acts having effects on rights and obligations in domestic law? And are the EU treaties just like other treaties, or do they occupy a more foundational place in the constitutional law of the UK and of its constituent nations? So I'm not going to say anything more about that list of questions other than that's the list. The Divisional Court has got 3 days to grapple with that list, and the Supreme Court will have to look at it somewhat later. But there's a second and I think even more interesting, potentially even more interesting set of questions that one can sum up by asking, how will EU law cease to apply as such in the UK? Now, we all know that Theresa May has announced a great repeal bill. It's unclear when this bill is going to be introduced, but we know its introduction will be announced in the next Queen's speech, which is expected in either April or May 2017. And the announced plan is that the EU law that is currently in force by virtue of the European Communities Act will remain part of UK law unless and until repealed or revoked. In other words, that all existing EU law will, on Brexit Day, if that's the right name for it, become UK law. But that in itself raises more questions than it answers. One is it just EU legislation, or will it also be rules of EU law contained in the case law of the ECJ that will become part of UK law? If the former, will the UK courts have to follow ECJ precedent? Will it matter whether the precedent predates or postdates Brexit? If the UK courts will not have to follow pre-Brexit ECJ precedent, then the question whether any given EU law becomes part of UK law or not is going to depend on how recently the EU legislation has been updated or consolidated, a rather odd thing for that rather fundamental question to depend on. If they do have to follow pre-Brexit ECJ precedent, how will the government square that with its desire to free us from the jurisdiction of the ECJ? Another set of questions arises when one considers what happens to EU legislation that confers powers on the Commission or on EU institutions. Quite a lot of EU legislation would actually be meaningless, shorn of these powers. Now, in a statement given on Monday of this week, David Davis, the Secretary of State for exiting the EU, appeared to recognise this. And here's what he said. He said, there is over 40 years of European Union law in UK law to consider in all, and some of it simply won't work on exit. We must ensure that there is no black hole in our statute book. That's what he said. Well, now, what does that mean? Presumably it means that in the thousands of instances where EU law makes reference to the Commission or to other EU institutions, a choice is going to have to be made. You could simply decide not to incorporate the legislation into UK law at all. So you could say that because a reference is being made to an institution that can't now exercise the relevant power, we're simply not going to incorporate that bit of EU law into UK law. Or you could try and repatriate the powers that are presently exercised by the EU institutions. But if you're going to do that, you are then going to have to make another decision. Who is going to exercise these powers in the place of the Commission or the other institutions? Should it be the UK government or a devolved government or local government or some independent agency? Now, it doesn't take a political genius to see that the answers to these questions are going to be quite contentious. Will these answers be supplied by Parliament itself in the Great Repeal Bill or in subsequent primary legislation? If so, presumably Parliament is likely to be doing little else for some years. If not, the Great Repeal Bill will have to contain Henry VIII clauses authorising the executive to decide these potentially controversial questions. Now, if these Henry VIII clauses are extremely broad, the referendum will have resulted in an unprecedented transfer of power from Parliament to the executive, a curious result given the centrality of parliamentary sovereignty to the narrative of the Leave campaign. My own view, for what it's worth, is that the task of deciding which parts of EU law should be incorporated into UK law post-Brexit will be a Herculean one, which will be well beyond the capacity of Parliament, whether in the Great Repeal Bill or in the years thereafter. So there will be no option but to delegate quite a lot of the key decisions to the executive. But I also doubt that Parliament will be willing to give the government completely blank checks on this. So it's likely to insist on carefully drawn delegated powers. In some cases, there's going to be a real issue about whether the powers can constitutionally be exercised without the consent of the devolved legislatures. And another thing that tends to happen when governments have to make politically controversial decisions is that they embark, of course, on consultation exercises. A cynic might think that one of the purposes of such exercises is to delay the point at which a politically difficult decision has to be taken. And that brings me neatly on to my third set of questions. What kind of public law challenges are we likely to see as the process of repatriating EU law unfolds? Well, the first, and it seems to me obvious, kind of public law challenge that people in this room are likely to have to get involved in quite soon is this, that unless the delegations given in the Great Repeal Bill are very broad, there's going to be a series of vires challenges to the instruments that incorporate EU law into UK law. Questions are going to have to be answered along these lines. Can the instrument validly abrogate statutory rights existing separately from the ECA? Can it validly affect past transactions? Can it confer or take away property rights? And these are just some of the very obvious questions that you would have to ask in any, looking at any piece of subordinate legislation, applying the normal canons of statutory construction that apply whenever you're interpreting any piece of primary legislation. And a second, it seems to me very likely, source of public law challenges is going to be consultation challenges. If the government does choose to consult on any of these instruments, and as I've said, history suggests that governments do like to consult, if only as a means of delaying the evil day, then expect there to be a raft of litigation arising out of those consultations. Now, my fourth set of questions can be grouped under the heading, what will public law look like shorn of EU law? And I've got really two observations on this topic. The first is that when historians come to look at the reaction of the UK courts to Brexit, I think the case law of the last few years will bear out the conclusion that it wasn't completely unexpected by our courts. And when I was studying law 20 years ago, a great deal of attention was being given by academics, though not practitioners, to the question whether the EU legal order had a constitutional force and status that was distinct from the domestic statutes that gave it effect. And Professor Elliott has already talked about some of the cases that, since that time, have addressed that very question. My view is that recent decisions of the Supreme Court, in particular in Assange and in HS2, have pretty firmly squashed the idea that EU law has a constitutional source and status separate from the acts of Parliament that give effect to it. Those cases make clear that EU law has effect because Parliament says so, and only to that extent. But equally, the UK courts have for some years been trying to persuade those who appear before them that there is no need to keep reaching for EU law. And this was a theme, a sort of leitmotif in the jurisprudence of the UK courts that's been developing long before the referendum, before even the referendum was announced. What we keep being told, I think, or have been told lately by the judges, is that the common law has, by a process of osmosis, absorbed many of the key principles that you see reflected in EU law. So, for example, it will not be long, I think, everyone would agree, before the Supreme Court finds a suitable case in which to declare that we have moved on from Wednesbury and that proportionality in some guise is now a principle of review in domestic law. The same may well be true of the principle of equality or non-discrimination, which found its way into EU law as a principle derived from the constitutional traditions of the member states. It is, I would suggest, surely not too much of a stretch to suppose that Brexit might prompt our courts to start adopting as common law principles those that we became accustomed to applying when members of the EU. The second observation is that until now, most public lawyers practising in an area where both EU and convention rights are available would, given the choice, rather plead a case based on EU law than based on convention rights. EU law remedies are, for a start, almost always better. Once EU law ceases to become available, that is inevitably going to focus attention on the convention. Now, we know a couple of things about the convention. One is that Theresa May has, in the past, favoured withdrawal from it. A second is that she indicated very clearly when she stood to be Tory leader that she was no longer going to pursue that particular proposal. But it remains the case that a substantial portion of opinion on the in the Conservative Party does favour withdrawal. Now, we also know that in recent years, the Strasbourg Court has been pretty conservative when it comes to judgments concerning the United Kingdom. But anything which increases public focus at home on the convention has the potential to inflame opinion against it. So if I had to predict areas of growth for public law over the next few years, my bet is on developments in the common law, not new activism based on the convention. Now, my fifth and final topic is, it's a brief one, but I thought probably I ought to mention it. How will EU law develop without us? You can see that I'm getting towards the acceptance stage of the seven stages now. Well, so far I've been looking at how UK law might develop if and when we are outside the EU. But of course, there is another equally important question, which is how EU law is likely to develop once we leave. Now, on one level, you might think that the answer to that question is, well, who cares? We won't be subject to it. But even the most ardent Eurosceptic would, I think, have to admit that whatever deal we manage to negotiate, EU law is going to continue to have an impact on us long after we leave. Not least because so many British nationals will continue to live in the EU and so many British companies will continue to trade or aspire to trade with the EU. How might they be affected by developing EU law in a post-Brexit world? Well, that's an enormous topic, and not one that I can say a great deal about, but I'd like to just end with one little vignette from a case that I'm involved in at the moment, which is before the ECJ. The case is not one about a subject which, on the face of it, sounds like one of fundamental constitutional importance. It's a case about aviation emissions, and I was acting for a Swiss airline. One of the main issues in the case is whether a company can complain about a decision of the EU institutions which involves unjustified or allegedly unjustified discrimination against a third country, in our case, Switzerland. The hearing in this case was in, date's important here, May. The UK government sent their counsel to argue that the principle of equality or non-discrimination does not apply at all in relation to discrimination against third countries. In other words, the EU legislature is free, as a matter of law, to treat one third country less favourably than all others for any reason or none. Judgment is awaited. I wonder if that is an argument they would be making today. I think I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin, for that tour de force of the horizon that awaits us, with the silver lining, if any, that at least there are going to be lots of interesting cases. We've got a few minutes for questions to Martin on Brexit. I'm going to start. What's going to happen on the case? Imagine yourself, many would say easy, sitting in the Supreme Court. What the court's going to do?
I'm going to duck that one, I'm afraid, because I'm...
Are you in it?
I'm representing a party that has an interest in that case.
Ah, OK. Yes. That's a quick answer. Any other questions or, indeed, contributions on Brexit and where it's taking us in the coming years? Yeah.
I'm Joe Betts from the Public Law Project. I wondered whether you had any thoughts about the Charter of Fundamental Rights and whether the government is going to be in a particular hurry to abolish that, or whether it's going to take its time and see that off in due course, maybe as part of any reform that happens to the Human Rights Act.
My expectation is that the government will regard the Charter of Fundamental Rights as an integral and, to them, one of the most objectionable parts of EU law, and I cannot see, in the light of the statements that have been made about taking us out of the jurisdiction of the ECJ, that the government could possibly have in mind to leave in place something such as the Charter, which gives such leeway to the ECJ to engage in the kind of thing that some would regard as judicial activism.
It's going to be top of the list, isn't it?
Yeah, I think if the import of your question was, well, maybe they'll leave the Charter in place, I'm afraid we need to get beyond that particular stage of grief, I think. It's not going to happen.
Well, no other questions, Martin. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Well, it's a great privilege.